Raymond Johnson v. Loftus. Mr. Richard.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
My name is Chris Reichart, and I represent the petitioner appellant Earl Johnson. Defense counsel at Johnson's murder trial.
Speak up, please.
Defense counsel at Johnson's murder trial made numerous decisions that could only have been losing propositions for the defendant. His choices greatly undermined the strength of a defense Johnson could have presented while doing nothing to increase Johnson's chances of obtaining acquittal. As a result, these decisions cannot be described as objectively reasonable or even minimally intelligent. Accordingly, counsel was not functioning as the counsel guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment. The case presented by the state was extremely weak. It consisted of two eyewitnesses who had an opportunity to observe the gunman only for a limited period of time at night from a distance while they were being shot.
What was the distance?
Of half a block, Your Honor.
So how many feet?
It's not clear exactly from the record, Your Honor.
Well, what does that mean?
It would presumably be half a...
I don't understand. You have a case where it's extremely important what the distance is. So if it's half a block, you go measure the block, and then you know what the distance is. So why isn't that in the record?
It was never presented by either the state or by the defense, Your Honor.
Tell me, did these people all know each other?
Leo Patterson, the victim, knew Johnson's mother and had some acquaintance with Johnson.
Patterson and then the two witnesses are all brothers, right?
They're all brothers.
And the witness, you say, was not called, this 12-year-old.
That's right.
Lives on the same block. And mm-hmm. So when the Patterson, who are the witnesses here, testify that, point to the shooter, this is somebody that they knew from the neighborhood, isn't it?
It's not. There's no evidence in the record whether they knew him or not. If they had known him, the fact that it took them three police lineups to be able to identify him as the shooter would be truly inexplicable. It may be that they didn't know him
it is a fact, is it not, that they lived in the same street?
That's not clear as to Daryl and Dexter Patterson. Their address isn't provided in the record, and although they went to Leo's house after the shooting, it's not clear if that's simply the place where they retreated to or if they lived there. It's just not in the record.
Who is the guy who confronted Leo?
His identity hasn't been... It's not in the record, Your Honor. I think he's simply described as a young man in the record. Daryl had initially identified him as one of the gunmen, but then at the initial police lineup, identified that individual as a person who had talked to Leo, but stated that he was not, in fact, one of the gunmen, as Daryl had initially said he was. The only other evidence, in addition to these two eyewitnesses presented by the state that linked Johnson to the crime, was the statement of Fred Johnson, Earl Johnson's younger uncle. However, even the trial judge described Fred Johnson as a man willing to answer any question you want him to answer, any way you want him to answer it, stated that he was probably an incompetent witness and was not helpful to either side. Therefore, the state did not put on a strong case, and if even some of the exculpatory evidence Milton Blum, Johnson's defense attorney, could have presented was shown to the jury, there's a reasonable likelihood that the outcome of the trial would have been different. This case is governed by AEDPA. However, the state has acknowledged that the Illinois court applied the wrong standard in analyzing the prejudice prong of Strickland. Accordingly, the state court's prejudice determination is not entitled to any deference under AEDPA. Blum provided ineffective assistance in at least three ways. First, he failed to request a mistrial after half of the alibi witnesses...
Even when you say a credibility determination is not entitled to any deference?
A credibility determination is not entitled to any deference?
Now what you just said?
No, Your Honor, I may have misspoken. The state court's prejudice determination
is
not entitled to deference. Blum had intended to call six alibi witnesses who were with Johnson at the time of murder. These witnesses would have testified, as Johnson did, that at the night of the shooting, they were at home watching Home Alone 2. However, three of those witnesses were in the courtroom during some of the testimony, and therefore the trial judge excluded them from testifying. The trial judge essentially told Blum that he would give him a mistrial and gave Blum an opportunity to consider whether or not he wanted to accept a mistrial. Blum failed to accept the judge's offer, even though he would have been able to obtain
a mistrial. Well, did he give a reason why he didn't want to accept the mistrial?
Blum never gave a formal explanation as to why.
Did someone ask him? Or?
He was never asked. He never stated it in his affidavit and wasn't asked about it during the evidentiary hearing on the state post-conviction
petition. Well, doesn't your client have an obligation to ask the lawyer why he made a particular decision?
I don't believe that he does, Your Honor. Especially when the reasons why Blum made his decision can be gleaned from the record.
Well, I don't understand. I mean, see, a lawyer might feel, you know, there's a pretty good jury, something like that, and the incremental effect of a parade of alibi witnesses wouldn't be positive, and he didn't want to gamble on a different jury. That'd be perfectly reasonable. So why don't we have any information about that?
Why previous counsel never examined this, I'm not entirely sure, Your Honor.
Well, not only is that perfectly reasonable, but why shouldn't we assume that that's why the lawyer did not ask for a mistrial?
Well, then, there are two reasons, I think, that have been put forward by the court and by the state that might justify Blum's decision. The first would be...
Why wouldn't just what Judge Posner said justify it? You already put on three alibi witnesses. Another couple isn't going to make much difference, and you might think you're in just as good a position that it's not going to be any better retrying this case 2 months from now. And
Blum clearly didn't believe that. He had gotten all six alibi witnesses to the courtroom, had intended to call them.
Yes, of course he intended to call them, but when they suddenly are unavailable, he has a choice to make. Does he really want to have another trial with a different jury, which might be less favorable? Now, maybe not, but you'd think you'd want to ask the lawyer that before you decided he was guilty of ineffective assistance.
Well, there are oftentimes, I believe, cases where...
I mean, you have the burden of proving that there was ineffective assistance. And that means that the lawyer did something which couldn't be defended as some reasonable strategic decision. So to make your case, don't you have to ask the person, you know, why did you do this? Why didn't you take the mistrial so you could have your other alibi witnesses?
I don't believe, Your Honor, that there is a procedural requirement to...
I don't understand. How do you prove ineffective assistance when you have an ambiguous decision by a lawyer? It could be perfectly reasonable, but maybe not, so we have to ask him.
Well, I think, Your Honor, in the context of this record, it can't be described as perfectly reasonable. There's nothing suggesting that the jury pool that... Blum had assumed
it was. But you're now shifting the burden to the state. Why don't you have the burden to show there's nothing to suggest any reason, which would require you to ask him, why did you do this? And if he says, I don't want to come back, I don't want to be bored doing this trial again, then you'd have a much stronger case.
Well, it wouldn't always be possible to do that. Blum did give an affidavit in this case, although it's not clear. He only addressed a few of the issues relevant to the ineffective assistance.
So he gives the affidavit. What's the next step?
The next step would presumably to be tasked for an evidentiary hearing. Johnson did receive an evidentiary hearing in the state court in his post-conviction petition, but the focus of that hearing was actually a state actual innocence claim.
So what's the sequence? The affidavit is submitted and then there's an evidentiary hearing?
I believe that was the order that occurred in this case, Your Honor.
And did Blum, is that the lawyer's name?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Did he testify at this evidentiary hearing?
He did, again, principally on an actual
innocence claim. So was he asked by somebody, you know, why did you not accept the mistrial?
He was not asked that question.
Why isn't that dropping the ball?
It may have been something that post-conviction counsel should have raised, although, again, the context of that was the state
court. I don't understand context of it. If you want to show ineffective assistance, you've got the lawyer right there. His affidavit hasn't addressed a critical issue, so and there's a lawyer there for the defendant. So why doesn't the lawyer ask him? And if he doesn't, why should we upset a conviction because an actually represented post-conviction petitioner didn't ask a critical question?
Well, at that point, Your Honor, I believe that the claim based on the failure to present these witnesses, I believe the state judge had already dismissed those as a matter of law and was having the evidentiary
hearing. What does that mean, dismissed as a matter of law?
My understanding is that there is essentially a two-step process in Illinois. Initially, the court will get rid of either on its own motion or upon the request of the state any claims that appear not to have any valid legal or evidentiary support, or which the court concludes don't have a legal or evidentiary support, and will then have an evidentiary hearing on any claims that may remain, which I believe is what occurred in this case, Your Honor. And I believe the claims related to the mistrial had already been disposed of by the time of the evidentiary hearing, which focused on this state actual innocence claim, which isn't presently before this court.
Judge DeCadish has, I think, something he'd like to add here.
If I might, very, very briefly. It seemed to me that the question of when the lawyer would be asked, it would be in the state's tactic, it would be in the state's purview or their part of the case, because when it comes to a petition for post-conviction relief, it would be in the state's interest to demonstrate that it was a tactical decision. So if the lawyer was on the stand during the post-conviction hearing, it would be in the state's...
Mr. Kadish, what you say is absolutely correct, except for one thing. There's a presumption of the competency of the lawyer, and that's the position taken. So the burden is on the opponent of that position to bring the evidence out, not to negate it.
But if every time I've ever had a post-conviction petition...
I understand your position completely, right. But I pointed out the opposite.
Well, again, when you look at the record of this discussion that Blum had with the judge at the mistrial, it's clear that his concern was with the delay. In fact, one of his questions he asked the judge was, well, how long will it take me to get a new trial setting? It's also clear that he thought these were important witnesses because he was very upset by the fact that they had entered the courtroom and wouldn't be able to testify. If he thought these witnesses really wouldn't have added that much to the case, it's doubtful that he would have had the emotional reaction.
Well, it's such
that he
a
did.
Silly arguing in a vacuum. Why isn't he asked, if you thought these witnesses were so important, why didn't you accept the mistrial?
Again, that question was simply never asked. And again, I think it's because
it's gone through years of this stuff, and no one asks the most simplest question.
I don't, Your Honor, have an answer.
You're into your rebuttal time. Escape.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, you'll have some more time. So, Mr. Fisher.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counselor, may it please the Court, I am assistant.
How long is half a block?
Actually, Your Honor, the distance is in the record on page 26 of the supplemental appendix. Daryl Patterson is being questioned. The question is, and how far away was the car from you as now it came to 6th where you were at? He responds, about 10 feet. How was the lighting when the car came down? It was light. You could see. I could see. Yes, I could see the person.
Light from street light or?
He testified the car was between two street lamps, in the sort of penumbra of two street lamps when he saw it.
Let me ask you, I thought that was a little overstatement. In your brief, summarizing the strength of your case on page 15, you say, quote, there were multiple eyewitnesses against the petitioner. There were two, and one was drunk to three times the Illinois state limit. And counsel didn't emphasize that point, but I thought it was one of the better arguments made here about not the jury not knowing that this guy was .289 or something. So to say there were multiple eyewitnesses against the petitioner is sort of stacking the deck, I think.
Trump was seeing double, so there
you go. It was certainly not my intent to overstate the case. There were two witnesses, the two surviving Patterson brothers, who identified petitioner both in the lineup and in court, as well as the signed written statement from Fred Johnson that he saw petitioner fire at the Pattersons. And the jury in the case was aware of the imperfections in the eyewitnesses in this case. They made the determination about the credibility of those eyewitnesses.
The jury didn't know how drunk Dexter was, or one of the two Patterson guys.
They did not know his precise blood alcohol level, but he was impeached in cross-examination and stated that he had been...
When did they take the blood level?
I'm not aware of the exact time. I believe it was medical report from the night of the shooting.
How did he come to give blood, or whatever, however they determined his blood alcohol content?
He was shot, Your Honor.
Pardon?
He was shot, Your Honor. I believe he was at the hospital.
They took it and did it then.
That's my impression, Your Honor. I can examine the record to make sure that's correct, but that is my impression, Your Honor.
That makes sense, so I'll accept that.
His brother also, on cross-examination, testified that he was drunk that evening, not just that he had been drinking.
That his brother was drunk.
Correct. Sorry. He
had one sober, one and one drunk.
Correct, Your Honor. And the jury was aware of that, and they also had the opportunity to see Fred Johnson.
Isn't there a Latin expression in wine or is truth?
In vino veritas?
Yes,
Your Honor. To address a couple other points from petitioner's argument, the post-conviction...
Fred's identification is, of course, important since he wasn't being shot at. But and of course, he's not severely retarded, but he is retarded. Now, what was the basis on which he was impeached?
Defense counsel elicited testimony from him recanting his signed written statement to police. He, in essence, became another alibi witness on the stand, stating that
his initial identification was important evidence for the state.
The signed written statement, yes, Your Honor. And there was testimony, not only did Fred Johnson admit that he signed that written statement that night, but the assistant state's attorney and police officers who took the statement testified as to the conditions under which it was given.
Wasn't there evidence that he was badgered easily led around?
There was no evidence other than his own statement that he was told that he was going to do jail time, that he was badgered. In fact, he testified that he was treated well. He was allowed to go to the bathroom. He was given food, drink, cigarettes. And the officers and assistant state's attorneys involved actually testified that he was not told what to say or badgered in any way. In terms of his credibility, that evidence about his capacity was in front of the jury, and they had an opportunity to see him themselves and make a credibility determination regarding what he was saying in the courtroom. And the judge did find him to be a competent witness. And there's some discussion about how competent, but the central determination is that he was competent enough that he felt comfortable letting the jury make a determination about the credibility of his testimony. The post-conviction court actually held that the ineffective assistance of counsel claim was a matter of res judicata. It did go on to discuss prejudice and cited properly to Strickland, although it did, in its shorthand, misstate the prejudice standard. It was the direct appeals appellate court that actually determined the claim on the merits, and it reasonably determined that counsel's performance in this case was not deficient. And that determination is, of course, entitled to deference under the AEDPA. Counsel in this case presented a vigorous alibi defense. He had prepared every witness who allegedly could have testified to petitioner's whereabouts at the time of the crime. He presented three of them. The three he did not. It was no choice of his own to have them violate the judge's orders not to come in during testimony. His choice was not between preparing and calling all six or preparing and calling three. He had to make a strategic choice between proceeding with the witnesses who were available to him or taking the obvious risks and, in fact, sacrifices in this case that came with any delay. He had already begun cross-examining state's witnesses. He had showed his hand for at least some of these state's witnesses. And considerations like that, though they may not be explicitly on the record in terms of a conversation with defense counsel, can be drawn from the record, evidently. And to ignore those kinds of considerations would turn the deference that Strickland affords defense counsel for strategic decisions on its head. The decision whether or not to seek a mistrial has been held by this court in Golowski to be a question of trial strategy. And as you mentioned, Your Honor, in addition to having revealed his hand regarding cross-examination, there were questions of jury composition and availability of witnesses that are inherent in any delay, whether it was 2 months or whether it would have turned out to have to have been much longer. There was a discussion about whether these three cumulative witnesses, defendant's ex-girlfriend, brother, and mother's boyfriend, were seen as important or key or whatnot. There's obviously some value in calling witnesses 4, 5, and 6 to the alibi, but I think it's actually clear from the record that defense counsel didn't view them as key witnesses. Before he made his decision, the trial court actually said to him, I know what I would do if I considered them to be key witnesses. And counsel then, after having talked to them and had several minutes to consider his decision, decided to proceed forward. I think it's clear that counsel made a strategic decision that these witnesses were not, in fact, key witnesses. Nor do I think there's a reasonable probability that the outcome of the trial would have been different if he had made a different choice. The jury had heard the alibi defense. They had.
Is there any argument by the state that there were supposed to be 6-7 people watching Home Alone 2 and you only heard from a few of them, so if it was really true, there would have been more of them here?
No, Your Honor. I do not believe that in closing arguments or anywhere there was a reference by either party to this issue. That's my recollection of having reread closing arguments. The petitioner does present a couple of other factual bases to support his ineffective claim. One of these is the failure to use the medical records to impeach Patterson regarding his precise blood alcohol level. And this court held in Stevens that though ineffectiveness is one claim, if the petitioner fails to properly present one of the aspects of counsel's behavior to the state courts, that can create a procedural default. The state appellate court found in this case that petitioner had waived this basis by failing to include it in his post-conviction petition. And in fact, in its brief on post-conviction in the appellate court, the state did write that even if defendant's claims were not barred by both res judicata and waiver. And this court's repeatedly held that waiver under this section of Illinois law is an adequate state law ground, creating a procedural default. It did so in Wright. It did so in Szabo. And also, just to clarify, proceedings and post-conviction petitions in Illinois, since I know there were a couple of questions for petitioner, it's actually basically a three-step process. First, the court reviews to see if there's the gist of a constitutional claim and makes that determination on its own. Then there's briefing allowed, and if it doesn't conclude the case from the written from the written proceedings, then it moves on to a hearing. And affidavits are required to support the post-conviction petition in those earlier stages.
I kind of suggested that really there was no opportunity to examine the lawyer about his strategic decisions because the court had held as a matter of law that the absence of the witnesses was not actionable.
The affidavit in support of his post-conviction ineffective assistance claim could have covered any materials that counsel at that point had sought to ask Mr. Vollm about, and that affidavit, in fact, would have been required in support.
The affidavit is procured by the defendant?
Well, in fact, defendants are required to support their claims via affidavit and
So in other words, Johnson's new lawyer, went to Blum and got an affidavit?
I believe so, Your Honor. I would have to double-check and make sure the affidavit in this case is from Johnson's lawyer, but affidavit support would be required.
So you're saying he could have asked the lawyer.
There's no reason he couldn't have taken an affidavit on that factual basis. So the factual basis involving the medical evidence about Patterson's intoxication has been procedurally defaulted, but in any event, defense counsel did cross-examine Patterson and his brother about that issue.
During the first trial, the primary trial.
Yes, Your Honor. And brought to the jury's attention.
So everybody knew he was drunk.
The imperfection.
It's a question of how drunk is all.
Correct, Your Honor. The final factual basis that petitioner brings up to support his ineffective claim is the failure to canvass the neighborhood and identify Rashawn Hubbard as a potential alibi witness. First, Your Honors, the district court specifically rejected a CA for this factual basis, and I realize that that's inconsistent or may be inconsistent with this court's holding in Thompson that once a CA says ineffectiveness, it implicates all preserved aspects of counsel's behavior. But whether or not it's a question of exercising discretion to expand the CA or reviewing the merits, counsel's performance was not ineffective in this aspect. His performance was not deficient in failing to canvass the neighborhood because he had already identified all of the potential witnesses who claimed to be able to actually testify about petitioner's whereabouts at the time of the crime. And as in all three factual bases, the determination that counsel made reasonable decisions in presenting his alibi defense involving all of the witnesses who claimed to be able to testify to his whereabouts, in impeaching Patterson with his own testimony, his brother's testimony, in deciding to go forward with three strong, in his mind, alibi witnesses rather than take the risks inherent in a delay, are all reasonable strategic decisions that are entitled to deference under Strickland, and the Illinois Appellate Court made those determinations where they were not procedurally defaulted, and that, too, is entitled to deference under the AEDPA. I'm out of time, Your Honor, so if you have no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Richard, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
Two minutes?
I'll address only a few issues, Your Honor. First, it would be extremely unfair to require petitioners such as Johnson to present affidavits from their trial attorneys showing attempting to demonstrate why they performed unreasonably. Johnson,
I don't understand you. Is Mr. Fisher correct that his post-conviction lawyer went to Blum and asked for an affidavit?
I don't know how the affidavit came into existence, Your Honor.
But there is an affidavit from Blum, and it was submitted by the petitioner in the post-conviction hearing.
That's correct. It's not. It only addresses some of the issues.
I mean, it is obviously either prepared by the attorney or prepared by Blum himself. Am I correct?
That's likely, Your Honor, although it may well have been.
It's Blum's affidavit, so one or the other had to prepare the deed.
Right. It would have been presumably defense. But defense counsel couldn't. Blum may not have been willing to talk about that issue.
Say that. That's fine, of course.
We simply don't know, Your Honor.
Well, whose burden is it? That's the question.
Well, initially.
Can you just go to the post-conviction court and say, you know, my client lost, so there must have been ineffective assistance?
No, Your Honor. You would have to show that the decisions made.
But you see, I don't see how the fact that he made the decision not to have a new trial is prima facie evidence of ineffective assistance. And if it's not, then it seems to me you have to put in something more.
I think based on the circumstances under which he did it, he essentially chose to proceed with a crippled alibi defense.
Precisely. He chose to proceed because he had to choose between more witnesses and a new jury and, you know, and having disclosed his hand, as Mr. Fisher said, having revealed his cards. So,
but
what's suspicious in what he did?
Well, he would have to raise the potential risks against the potential advantages.
Precisely.
And when you look at the advantages in this case, Your Honor, there really weren't
any.
That's
what you can't do without hearing from the lawyer. You know, were you worried that you had a great jury, or were you worried that you'd revealed some really clever ploy in cross-examination? Or what? Or were you just impatient?
So here's your chance to take advantage of the fact that your red light is on.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, one could speculate as to all of those potential reasons, but if you look at the record in this case, not only is there nothing to support that.
You didn't make a record.
Well, but the record as to what was actually occurring at the trial, for example, on the issue of showing his hand, only two witnesses had testified. One of them was Leo's mother, who testified simply as a life and death witness.
Well, this is all new stuff.
Right? Well, that's
in your brief. Not in your brief or in the record.
I believe the discussion of that, Your Honor, for certainly as to the reply brief addresses the issue as to the jury and as to the potential inability to find witnesses.
Okay. Well, we'll look at that, Captain.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Richard, and thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client.